This is the fourth session of Life Enrichment for Couples, and this one is entitled Family of Origin, Fables, and Forgiveness. I'm going to solicit your help in this hour, as I have in the days past. A couple convictions come out immediately. One is that we have so much experience and data, information, ideas, knowledge, and practice in our lives that are valuable, often is not the issue of getting new information, as focusing on our life experience at the same time being accountable to it and making some decisions about that. And so again, we'll be working in some groups. Secondly, I'm going to ask for extra special assistance here to be... We might be creative about this hour. I have been stewing this afternoon, figuring out what are we going to do today, because what I've done in the past with this topic, I don't think will work in this forum with the diverse lifestyles, backgrounds, couples and singles and all kinds of other, well, I guess that kind of includes it all, doesn't it, experiences. So, I am optimistic that using an alternative method we can gain something through the hour. My goal is that you walk away from any session like this and say there's something I can take with me to use in my life. And that's a fundamental goal I have. The focus of this hour is taking up one of the six strengths of the family, six strengths of marriage, six strengths of an enduring relationship, and giving that attention and seeing how we can build on it. And the one to look at is the ability to see something positive in a crisis. The strength is to develop the art of seeing something positive in a crisis situation or adversity. A way of saying that is a way to make stepping stones out of stumbling blocks. And we can do that in a number of ways. We can do that by seeking help from a friend, by sometimes seeking professional help, and by utilizing the resources within our own households, homes, and families. The basic issue to look at today is for us to see what prevents us from seeing something positive in a crisis, and what are those resources in our midst to build on that. And let me flesh that out in terms of the scriptures, and as I have in the previous days, looking at how our worship life connects some of these basic strengths and relationships and models them. This is both scriptural and theological, and from our worship life is the Lord's Supper. In the Lord's Supper, we receive a crisis. We receive the death of the Christ in the form of bread and wine. And yet at the same time, as we receive this, these elements in our hands, in our lips, we see in them life, promise, hope, and strength. So it seems to me that it's well and good to see finding something positive in a crisis as a fundamental strength for our relationships. What I'd like us to do to begin with is to do some exploration, more general exploration of our own life experiences in some smaller groups, and look at those times when we've met crisis, and explore in ways that are safe for you, in ways that are non-threatening for you, but what are kinds of the issues that get in the way of making this a positive, seeing something positive in it. And then after a while, we'll do the same thing by seeing what are the positive resources that we can use. So what I'd like us to do is get into groups of 4 to 6 or something like that. If you can make some tight circles, and I'm going to pass out a piece of paper for each group, and use your experience, your knowledge, your thoughts, and come up with some of the things that get in the way of moving beyond, of crossing bridges from grief experiences, from any form of a crisis experience in your life. So if you could just get in some smaller groups, please. Do you have a pencil in that group? You need something to write with? I'll run through it again. Some of us are not sure we get the issue. You're not sure? Okay. Let me approach it this way. Loss, crisis, negative experiences that feel an ouch are experiences that we all have in life. And a fundamental need is to be able to work through it and to move beyond. And even, in fact, to take from that loss experience something that can be a maturing, a growing part of our life for the future. Does that help? A basic part of life is to be able to take our loss experiences and move beyond them, learn from them, and not be stopped, not get stuck. And sometimes we do. We get stuck for some time. We won't let go of the past. Okay? How can we let go, in fact, learn from it in a positive way? What are the kinds of things that happen in our lives that stop us? Question.
So you want us to discuss what makes us get stuck.
Yeah, what makes us get stuck with our loss and grief risk experiences? Well, only the top 20, please. Roadblocks to growth, okay? Roadblocks to growth. I'm hesitating to stop these conversations because I'm seeing a number of locations that it's clear to me there's some exciting things going on, and I can guess it's true in the others as well. But and now the challenge is on. What are we going to do in the group, and will I have anything to say about this? Because I'm hearing some of these conversations of not just identifying, but what do we do about it, and so forth. So that's really good. Welcome. Okay. Yeah, just join one of the groups. What I'd like us to do is to put this wisdom together and look at it and see what that suggests for us in getting our lives back on track after a loss, after grief, after a crisis, and moving forward again. So let's just go right around.
That's
we'll start
what we're
here.
Supposed to do? I thought we were supposed to do the stumbling block.
Yes, that's right. That's
not how to get over them.
No. No, we'll do that in the next one. Yeah. What are some of the stumbling blocks?
Aging parents? No, that's not. Well, sometimes.
No, underneath it would be guilt.
Various feelings, conflicting feelings,
yeah.
That's behind it? Okay.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Good. Okay. Is that what you meant?
I just want to make sure I understood what
being expressed there.
Looking at life from limitations instead of opportunities. Looking at life as well. I don't know. This wasn't a volunteer position.
Only looking for limits, okay.
Feeling sorry for ourselves. Whining.
Pity. Is pity okay?
Grief.
Pardon?
Grief.
Okay.
Okay.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay, good. Back here?
Yeah. Well, we put down bitterness and anger and We had all the personal feelings that she didn't know the names for.
You're just waiting to contribute those, aren't you? Okay.
Hurt, pride, fear, confusion.
And we had a happy group.
And we did put down isolation too, when we were starting to work into the next.
What was that?
Isolation.
Okay. Okay.
We had attitude also, where people just seemed to lack what we call a perspective selective awareness, and they always looked at a negative instead of a positive thing, and that's personal. Another one we had is the people around you who tend to be negative, and you've all seen those excuses where you try to come up with an idea, well, that's been tried before. Mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of things, but the people around
you. Okay, negative people around you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Physical shock, where we're so shocked we become immobilized, we can't move.
Okay, kind of numb for a mm-hmm. time.
Mm-hmm. And there are people who detest change. They are comfortable with change. It creates stress and it's hard to deal with. Denial. Lack of faith. And at the same time, too much faith.
I have some ideas on that. You want to say a little bit more? Too much faith? Meaning?
In self.
In self.
Okay.
You sure
overconfident.
Overconfident.
No. Yeah, overconfident. I can get it all
down. I'd write cocky, but is that C-O-C-K? No, we won't do that.
Okay. Another one is a lack of skill.
Good list. We got lots of reasons to be stuck, huh? I have about four or five different options to approach this. I think we'll, based upon what kind of comes out or has come out, and I'm thinking where to begin. I think where I want to begin is a number of the items mentioned have something to do with relationships to other. Isolation, difficulty in communicating, and the relational aspects of that. And to begin with, just to note that this sixth strength of enduring relationships is learning and growing through crisis intimately involves using the resources available to us, using the skills of the different family members. And yet, for some of us, that gets stuck, that gets stopped. One of the items here, lack of skill. Lack of rules. What I want to do is talk about in certain segments, a couple different segments. One is looking at the family of origin issues. Looking at what makes a family, the kind of things that affect us in the family. The climate. The way we communicate. Another thing I want us to do is to look at the concept of joining the marriage, which has impact, I think, for more than just married couples. But I want to approach it from that perspective. It's a concept that is fundamental to the success or failure of marriage, and I think also the success or failure of many other relationships. And then finally, the issue of the importance of forgiveness and letting go. And we talked about that in terms of being out of control. Joining the marriage. Can't write today. It's a concept in family theory and family therapy Because what is seen in relationships that break down, and first of all, we're in joining the marriage, talking about a marital relationship, but any kind of long, enduring relationship, is a commitment to one another. And let's focus on the family life and the marriage life. You've got family A, and you've got family B. And when you're first married, your commitment is not necessarily all taking place at the altar. It's a gradual process. In fact, it's a process that takes place before you're married. It's a process of looking at the family you grew up with and begin to cut some ties, huh? Begin to look to another person for a primary decision maker. So in the new marriage, you've got two different family styles of operating, an assumption that this style is universal if you're an A. An assumption that B style is universal if you're in B. And we find ourselves fighting, being disconnected because of assumptions. I'm not so sure we have a lot of that up there. But I was visiting with a sociologist one time, a family sociologist, and he was talking about a couple he was working with who'd been married 50 years. And the source of the problem was for the husband was that he feared the wife didn't love him anymore. And the reason was he didn't fix his eggs the way he wanted them. Simplest issue of lack of communication. And yet there's an assumption that if she didn't cook his eggs the way he assumed she knew, the way he'd always had them, because his a bottom line for him in family life was consistency. For hers was maybe more of, after 50 years, let's try something else. assumption, huh? Basic assumption. Let me give an example from the other spectrum. Joining the marriage means looking to each other as a primary decision maker. Looking to each other for naming the issues and resolving the issues, looking at the values that the two of you have. For many couples today, that isn't identified. That's one of those communication skills of how we work through issues is to be a team. But if we see ourselves in two different worlds, it doesn't work out that way. So we come to a crisis and we don't have the ability to lean on each other. Here's my example. And this is painfully true because it's a dear couple of friends of ours. But in the seminary days, this young couple been married about 2 or 3 years before with mom and dad's credit cards. And as decisions were being made in the home, there was this guilt feeling about who's the basis for the decisions. Is it us as the couple? Or is it mom and dad because they're paying for the bills with the credit cards? Car was paid for by parents. Housing bills were paid for by parents. And there's this constant need to go back to mom and dad to look at the their values. What would mom and dad want us to do with that money? A crisis, a major crisis came along. The husband's youngest brother died in an accident. And what came full-blown to their faces as a relationship, they hadn't learned the skills to relate to each other. They hadn't learned to depend on each other for their emotional support. Instead, what they did was fall back to each parental home, and the relationship ended up in a divorce. What I'm trying to get us to is to look at some of the basic ingredients of a home life that needs to be worked toward, and that takes years to develop. I like to name those. The process of joining a marriage involves merging two family systems into one.
So I'd like us to look at some of the basic components of a family system. And maybe you can see in some of your primary relationships, your marital relationship or another one, the process of adjustment from the way the family you grew up in did it and what's worked for you. And my hope is that maybe you'll see some of the strengths you have as you've matured in your life and some areas that are still valuable for you to look at. Say, hey, that's something I really haven't dealt with as an adult. First is the emotional climate. I said earlier, our basic experience in life is an experience of loss and grief. How we approach loss depends upon, becomes equated with the word of our level of anxiety. How anxious is our home climate? When we go through crisis, where is our dependencies? Emotional climate. When the anxiety level is low, it encourages, it fosters a higher self-worth, not only in the family, but also the individuals. So the anxiety levels related to the stresses we experience, the needs of individuals and family, and the dependencies that we have on others. With this couple, I was thinking of the dependencies were never broken free from mom and dad to one another. Another important skill, getting to the family life system, are the issues of boundaries. Who's included? Who's excluded? Where is my support system? Where is it lacking? A basic boundary is mom, dad, when there's a mom and dad pair, and children, to use that model. One of the difficulties in dealing with crisis in the home where you have children involved is who's linked with whom? In a crisis situation, if mom and dad's relationship, if the two primary adults is not secure, then often there's a blockage here, and you've got maybe mother aligned with child, or dad aligned with child, and it stops the process of communication. It stops the process of resolving crisis. Roles that are taken on in the family. The rules and the myth. There are many others. What I like us to do is I'm trying somewhat anxiously myself now, is to look at some of the key ingredients to the home life and how it affects our ability to deal with crisis. Myth. The fable, the truth that we reinforce daily in our lives. If you look at your own individual family, you will perhaps see some adages, some truisms. Life is like this. Life is like that. And you reinforce that in your home environment. Pity, life is hard on me, life is hard on our family, yes?
almost any of those could fit into what I've heard is called your tape-recorded messages from home.
Okay, your basic tapes.
Maybe you can come up with some phrases like that, and I think of them as the kind of thing that revolves in a person's head when the crisis comes up. A real man can support his family, maybe. And then when he loses his job, that just shoots it. I say, that's your tape. That sort of thing could fit in here.
Yeah, it sure could. Well, it's kind of hard to just pick and choose here.
How to deal with anger.
In terms of the myths?
The different ways families have historically, two families historically dealt with anger. And how that might be the issue that's not.
What's communicable and what's not communicable?
In our home, we dealt with it maybe by denial, and they fought it out. You know, we don't. Our styles are completely different. So.
And some of that again gets back to kind of emotional tone, the atmosphere that's supported or not, and the differences therein. I can use your help at this point. One of my problems with this session is. I had a whole focus to begin with that dealt with just couples and to work in small groups, and I'm really floundering right now to figure out how to pull it all together with our different, some are coming as couples, some as singles. So your kind of comments are just helping me think, and I appreciate that.
Well, you might not be working as a couple in a home, but you might be functioning as a couple in a workplace. I mean, you know, maybe you work closely with someone else. I wouldn't think this would have to only apply to married people.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. No.
I mean, if you just take from whatever standpoint you are and apply it to the information you're giving us.
Are we still trying to merge two families in this scenario?
Or in a relationship.
Well, loyalty is a basis. Just the fact that you can depend on somebody else.
Okay, and that's the joining the marriage, loyalty to the spouse versus others.
But particularly in a marriage, if you don't trust the other person, then I don't think any of these other things have any meaning at all.
Yeah.
So there has to be an at least as much as I'm able to, an unlimited amount of trust in my wife. And that's not a tape from my home, by the way.
Trust is not a tape from your home?
No, that's a learned experience over the last 30 years.
Okay. So trust was not part of the climate that you grew up in?
No, distrust was probably the opposite of trust.
So that's part of a myth, a family myth, that becomes communicated. The family myth is you don't trust other people.
Right.
You need to be self-reliant. Okay.
Exactly.
And that works against the kind of communication of working through a crisis.
You know, I think another myth to look at too is that family problems should stay in the family. That maybe one person's family style of coping, when in fact it might be that you need to reach out.
There's no support. In fact, you better be private.
You could also put that into the workplace or any other significant relationship.
Not only is that a myth, but that becomes a boundary. So you have your family life, and a healthy family has some clear boundaries, but there's some fluidness there. There's a connectedness with other systems and a larger system, larger social system, and maybe other neighborhood systems overlapping. But if you have to live in a private world, then here you are, just all bottled up there. And any communication to come in gets stopped, and any cry for help gets stopped from the inside out. And that is very much a part of an unhealthy system that prevents the kind of skills and care and openness
What are some of the other issues? You're doing better than I am. That's helpful.
Maybe male-female roles. Men are like this, women are like that.
Okay. And in our day and age, the male-female roles are in transition. And it's very confusing. Where is the trust there? Oh, this is great. You're doing...
Half of the couple is in transition and the other is not, you have even greater boundary, greater separation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you're working out of old assumptions, family of origin, or just social expectations, and don't work through those, and most of us don't, then we're in trouble to resolve conflict when they come up, because we're not, there's the climate of distrust and we're not working as a team. Let me give some images of where that is for us in our culture today. We live in a culture that promotes egalitarian roles within the home, right? The prepare enrich instrument, it's a pre-marriage instrument that seeks to help couples look at their strengths and their weaknesses, their strengths and their work areas. And one of them is, do they have a traditional family setup of male roles and females, or is it an egalitarian? And the prepare enrich is not, the results are not based on one being better than the other, but is there consistency within the household? Does the wife and the husband, do they buy into the same kind of roles and rules? Most couples today, when they fill that out, talk about egalitarian styles. We share the responsibilities. We share the decision making. We share the workload. And I'm seeing the smiles in your faces already. What are you saying?
Sounds good.
Some research from just a few years ago on male-female workload in the home, where the team were saying that they were equal, where the woman worked outside the home as well as inside the home, she still did 3 times as much work inside the home. 3 times as much. So when I'm dealing with the young married couples or premarital couples, I say disregard that as a strength or as a weakness that may be valuable, but we don't live out on our expectations for ourselves. We simply don't.
I think in that study, wasn't it that the males didn't perceive that to be the case? Mm-hmm. That the women were doing
I'm not sure that's the same
thought,
study.
Oh, okay.
But
one
but continue
that
on.
I referred to was that the myth that the males had was that they were doing an equal portion of the perception was very different.
We are, aren't we?
I'll talk to you later.
I've been in a role reversal in our home where I've been Mr. Mom, my wife's been working full-time, and I've been studying full-time, and my schedule's more fluid, and I've picked up much more of the housework. And after 3 years, I still forget to do the laundry, truly. And my standards for vacuuming and cleaning are not my wife's. So yeah, there are some very different role issues.
I've
yes.
come to the conclusion that the only saving thing is a sense of humor. we're in our 50s, and our favorite story is the fact that I thought after we were married, I would get up and make my husband's coffee. And all we do now is laugh loudly over that very possibility.
Okay. Role expectations.
You know, when you think about what you expect of yourself, you get... Even, you know, the longer the people expect of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you couldn't laugh at it, you'd be in trouble.
The need for humor, yeah.
I was thinking of trying to think of an example. I wasn't here talking about a group earlier, but of the rules thing and the myth. But part of it is you don't even know what they are, and a lot of you are coming from your own family of origin. And I have experience, my husband and I were in a process of dealing with some conflict we were having with one another, or something where we each felt kind of unsupported by the other.
Mm.
And I was in a period where I was, you know, I was feeling pretty emotional about some things. Not even, in fact, within our marriage, my work had some things that were sort of freaking me. And it turned out, as we were talking with a very helpful third person, that my husband, when we looked at it, my husband was in a family where acting out negative emotions didn't exist, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, only positive emotions existed. So he was willing to help me, but what he wanted was for me to just get over it fast, because as long as you were going through this period where you were going to come home and be upset, he just was real stressed by it, because in the rules in his household, if any time he had ever been upset, he was supposed to shape up.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a rule. We didn't even have any clue this was really what was going on until we could name it and go back and construct some things that were happening. I, on the other hand, had this view that if I started asking for things, I would lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of this very cautious view that said, you know, don't ask for anything. What right do you have to have claims in this system?
Okay, so there's some very clear rules about what it means to be a member of a family,
yeah.
And how you are valued. That gets back to some of the mythology of pick yourself up by your own bootstraps. Another fundamental issue that you're also identifying there, but let me back up. You talked about rules that weren't clear because they were unspoken. And most of the rules we have in our homes are unspoken. They're assumed. And that's okay sometimes. But when it comes to the crisis points, then we need to stop and try to flesh out all our assumptions. What do you think I'm doing? Or what are we, you know, I'm thinking that this is what we're doing, isn't it? And this is the way we're supposed to operate, isn't it? Well, no. So those unspoken rules, especially in times of crisis, need to be brought out. And it needs to be done patiently, and preferably by speaking first about what your assumptions are in the crisis and how to work on it as a team. And let that be the give and take. The negative aspect of unspoken rules is that sometimes that's done on purpose. What's the point of unspoken rules to be kept unspoken? And a lot of family structures are that way.
You don't have to deal with it.
It means control. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're in the executive system. Especially if you're the decision maker. Often that means husband, wife, parent, whatever. But that can fluctuate. You know what's going on in your son's high school program, for example. And that's kept unclear. That fog gives power. Okay. The other basic issue is, what does it mean to be part of a family? Does it mean that we are a collection of individuals? Or does it mean that we breathe at the same time and eat at the same time? Individuation and participation. There are healthy spots along the continuum. It doesn't have to be right dead center in the middle. You can be a family that's more a collection of individuals. You can be a family with a little bit more collection of people who think and need to feel closer together. But the point is, if you come from a family with the one off-center and you're joined to somebody in the other off-center, and you can go for years without identifying that, then, thank you for that word, distrust. It creates a climate of distrust because you know what the rules are and you're not operating right. Well, in fact, we don't know what the rules are. Let me give some examples of individuation and participation in the extreme. In a family that is exclusively filled with individuals is a boarding house. At best, you might leave messages on the refrigerator. No, forget that. That's getting too close to home. You want more. What's that?
The answering machine.
Yes, that's right. I'm outmoded these days. Well, the extreme family wouldn't bother to leave the messages, because I am here to get sheltered and to eat, and most likely alone, and that's it. The other extreme is that if dad, let's say mom's a Democrat, everybody has to be a Democrat. If
If one person comes home feeling bad, the whole household has to join them, or that's not love. Okay? At some point, it's laughable, but very real. So what happens if you have, let's say, one person from a background that encourages doing things alone, and a healthy relationship needs certain alone time, and you are with a person who has a different perspective? Well, then going out bowling with somebody else, if you're this style and you go out bowling with somebody else, it says to this person, you don't care about me anymore. Behavior translated by the family of origin lifestyle. It's a fundamental issue in joining the marriage, is appreciating the definition of what it means to be a home in terms of the roles, the rules, what's permitted, what's not permitted, and so forth. And how do we learn that? How do we learn the differences? We learn the differences when we bump our toes on something, when something goes awry. Otherwise, we assume everything's A-okay. So what's critical at that point that develops the trust over 30 years is some other issues like testing the waters, experimenting, communication, testing out the rules and roles, having rituals that bond us, even when we're not sure what's going on. That's another way we're talking about the loyalty issue. The rituals that include the daily habits that we abide by, the special celebrations, the traditions that will allow us to tolerate a lot of variances and get beyond the pity, because I know I belong. Well, our families have lots of rituals, but we live in an age that doesn't really honor rituals, doesn't see its place. Family vacations, a couple gets married, to use a paradigm here, they have different expectations of what it means to go on vacation. For one, it means to do everything with the in-laws, with the family. For another, it means freedom and a release from that for a change. In our home, I made the mistake of not celebrating Gloria's, my wife's, birthday properly. It was a more casual event in my home life. Now, we obviously had birthday cake and so forth, but for Gloria, I gotta watch how I say this. It's my own bias, because I don't want it to sound unhealthy, because it is healthy. It's just, you know, it's here you're hearing from this other perspective. But my first thought was that the day stops and we got queen for the day. But I don't mean that sarcastically. I'm just, from my other perspective, that there's more focus and attention to she gets what she wants for three meals, or and you do a little extra favors around the house. And I'm lucky if I remember the day. And that's not good either, right? I mean, I'm not bragging about that at all. But that caused major conflict. And the issue was two different styles of the importance of a day of celebration. The message was, you don't really love me. Almost functional kind of difference, because the roles, the rules, the levels of participation and individuation going on in the home that need to be tested in our relationships. Other kinds of things that you find are issues in the home life, or helpful aids.
Well, we have a step parent situation, and what we found was helpful because of the complications around the holidays, especially with Christmas and
fourfold problems now.
Five or six. Yeah, and we just made sure that everybody knew exactly minute by minute where the kids were going to be. My son, his sons, when their mother was going to pick them up, when his dad was going to pick him up, and the only time we had a problem was the time we forgot to tell everybody where the times were, and it was just a total disaster on Christmas Eve, for goodness sakes, you know, everybody yelling and screaming. It was awful. So from then on, we've been doing this for about 16, 17 years, that we just made sure everybody knew exactly what was going to happen, and then that became a new ritual that we had to work out.
Spoken rules.
Yeah.
Bring out the clarity. In a situation where you have to, because
it's a situation where we haven't done this before, so what do you do? So there's an advantage in that. And maybe that could be a model and a routine to do with other aspects of the family life. Yeah. Well, you have been very helpful. I entered this hour rather chaotic, confused about how to bring in this, and you've done a very good job to assist this. One other issue I just want to name that has to do with a lot of these issues you talked about, grief experience, bitter, anger, and so forth, is the word forgiveness. And part of the problem of forgiving is our strong loyalty to the families we grew up in. We're so connected to those families we grew up in, the hardest people to forgive are where those loyalties lie. Sister, mom, dad, aunt, uncle. The greatest hostilities are in those environments. And yet Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, in relationship to the Lord's Prayer, that says, forgive as you've been forgiven, Jesus has the audacity, in a very non-Lutheran way, to say at the end of that prayer, if you do not forgive the sins of others, your sins aren't forgiven. Well, we're out of time, so let me just summarize what I think about that. I was in a class one time with a professor who was a scholar on Matthew, and his perspective was, well, Jesus is sounding like a parent here, where you say things you don't really mean. You overstate the case. If you don't do this, you know that's going to happen. What I liked about his example is that he was using daily human experience to infer what Jesus meant. But I think he used the wrong daily experience. We all know what it is like not to forgive. What is it like not to forgive? Corrosive. You're right, huh?
It's corrosive.
It's corrosive, it's destructive, it's self-destructive.
It's hell on earth.
It's anger, it's pity. You know, if we look at this list of things, and if we could forgive others, and underneath that means if I could forgive myself. And that's where I get linked to my family of origin stuff again. If I can let go that my relationship with my dad is not exactly what I want, and there's some disappointments in him and in myself, if I can forgive myself, then I can begin to forgive others too. There's this intimate web that's hard to get out of because of those immediate family ties. I was dealing with a separated wife one time who was just fill in the word, and her husband who had walked out. And our goal as a twosome in a conversation, the separated wife and myself, was to get her to go through a process that wasn't going to happen in a day or a week or a month, but a process of letting go for her sake, because it was destroying her. Destroying her with the anger, the fear, the confusion, the isolation. One of the major stumbling blocks, it seems to me, to moving on in a crisis is it can't happen that way. We don't forgive God. Life is our basic myth. Life is supposed to be pretty good to me. Life is supposed to be fairly painless. And we can't forgive ourselves. Well, our time is more than up. I thank you, and I hope in the process that there's been some conversation here that you can walk out the door and say, now as I look at dealing with crisis in my life, dealing with losses, what's an avenue, what's an area to work with, to look at more closely, to help make those bridges build quicker? Thank you for your help.